Welcome, one and all, to the Death Defying Human Flycast. My name is Max Romero, and I'll be your host on this one of a kind journey into the world of a superhuman. Nope. Welcome, one and all, to the Death Defying Human Flycast. My name is Max Romero, and I'll be your host on this one of a kind journey into the world of a superhero stuntman called the Human Fly. With me today on our very first episode is longtime comics fan, Marvel scholar, and my very good friend, Patrick Joseph. Thanks for joining me, Patrick.
I am so glad to be here, Max. You know, I have a deep, deep love for licensed comics, and this is one of the stranger ones that came out of the 70s.
That is exactly why I came to you, Patrick. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background with comics?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been reading comics my entire life, first discovering them with an episode of the Ralph Bakshi Amazing Spider-Man cartoon. And if you hear bass in the background, because I live in a happening neighborhood. So that and the Super Friends hooked me. I started reading around age 4 or 5 with Marvel Team Up and Tarzan and Scooby-Doo, and it just snowballed from there. And here I am 45 years later, still reading them and still finding a lot of love and joy out of stuff, specifically from the mid-60s to the mid-80s, I'd say, is probably my main area of focus the last decade or so. I had mentioned really being into licensed comics. I really do enjoy comics that can't be reprinted. It forces you to go back and see the original artifact, take in the ads, the culture, and those licensed comics tend to be a reaction to the pop culture of the time. So that's an extra level of fascination for me. It's part of the overall tapestry of the time period and what was popular and what was moving pop culture at the time. So Human Fly absolutely encapsulates that in a really special and unique way.
It really does. I mean, and I know that your soft spot is, I would say, Bronze Age Marvel. Is that fair to say?
Bronze Age Marvel and DC.
And DC, yeah. Forth. Yeah. What you're saying, I mean, Human Fly, and this is, we were just talking about it off air, but there was a weird period in American pop culture where stuntmen and truck drivers and people like that were somehow like these cultural heroes. You know, it was sort of like a modern Pecos Bill all of a sudden. The Human Fly just kind of grabbed onto that with both hands and shook it for all it was worth.
Yeah, he was definitely, I mean, you could cast him as a copycat in some ways, and I think he has his origins in a few different aspects of that, from Evel Knievel to pro wrestling to even D.B. Cooper almost. And I have this weird theory about that, but I'll save it for later, I think.
All right, then in that case, let me give everyone here a little background on the Human Fly, the comic and the person, because we have not mentioned that yet. But part of what was so unique about the Human Fly was that he was a real person. He was a living, breathing stuntman who somehow managed to get licensed by Marvel Comics for a 19-issue series. Let's get into that. From the very beginning, the Human Fly was a mystery. He premiered in his own title in September 1977, and the Fly, the character, was never referred to by anything other than his stage name. And like the Mexican wrestlers he somewhat resembled, he never removed his distinctive red and white mask. The character's backstory went something like this. After breaking nearly every bone in his body in the same car accident that killed his family, the Human Fly was told he would never walk again. It was considered a miracle that he had survived at all. But after enduring hundreds of hours of reconstructive surgery that ended up replacing most of his bones with a steel skeleton, the Fly began his own rehab program, pushing himself in secret through sheer will. First, he taught himself to stand and then walk, finally training himself to the point where he had the agility and strength, aided by that steel frame, to become a world-famous stuntman whose mission in life was to bring hope to those whose lives might seem hopeless. He was joined by a small crew of people, a pilot, Blaze Kendall, an engineer, Ted Locke, and a publicist, Arnie Berman, who all worked with him. And it was all for the benefit of mostly children and the disabled, people who he wanted to be an inspiration to. Over the next 19 issues, the Human Fly would team up with Spider-Man, Ghost Rider, White Tiger, Daredevil, and fight everything and everyone from gangsters and would-be supervillains to the laws of physics. Something unique about the Human Fly's heroics is that he never really wanted to be a hero, or at least not a superhero. He was happy with the idea of inspiring others and raising money for good causes, but circumstances kept him in the thick of adventure. Luckily for us, the Fly always rose to the occasion. Unluckily, the Fly's time was destined to be short and the title would be canceled suddenly and without warning, apparently a surprise to both readers and the creators working on the title. Like a lot of licensed stuff, this was being written by Bill Mantlo, who people know from... Help me out here, Patrick.
Hulk, Micronauts, Rom. He created Rocket Raccoon and wrote a little bit of everything at Marvel at some time or another in a very brief but intense flurry of action that lasted... Oh, gosh, what? Oh, Cloak and Dagger, too. He created them. And he had a common theme throughout his work of body horror, and I think that Human Fly plays right into that with the whole 60% solid steel frame element, along with the mutilated body and all that.
That's a very good point. And do you ever wonder if he, do you think he is disfigured? Do you think that's part of the reason he wears the mask? Because supposedly the whole thing about him never taking the mask off is because he wants to be every man. But I kind of wonder if there's like a little Unknown Soldier stuff going on there.
Well, Unknown Soldier definitely occurred to me, particularly in the kind of training montage sequence in the comic, which was really just sort of one panel broken down into eight images. But he had a bandaged face. And really the only other characters I can think of that went through that were Larry Trainer in Doom Patrol, who's a stunt pilot. And then, of course, the Unknown Soldier, who was almost killed by an exploding grenade. That permanently mutilated him. So there is definitely a history in comics of bandaged people who are disfigured and hide that and go on to do heroic deeds. So I think there's a probability there. Also in real life, there's the speculation, and I don't want to step on you if you wanted to get to this later, but that there may have been multiple people, at least on the talk show circuit, that were the Human Fly's public face. And since his whole face wasn't shown on television programs, that could have been mutilation or it could have been an easy way to have him be in multiple places at the same time.
Right. Exactly. So, so that's pretty much the Human Fly as far as the comics are concerned. And that rolls right into what we were just starting to talk about. One of the most intriguing bits of the Marvel marketing is right at the top of, every issue of the Human Fly. The wildest superhero ever, because he's real. And, even for 70s Marvel, that was, some pretty unique hyperbole. they couldn't claim that with every character, but they could claim it with the Human Fly. Because back in
1970s... Bob Hope didn't have that.
Yeah, even Bob Hope or, Jerry Lewis, they didn't have that.
No. Definitely antecedents of real-life people having comics, but
right.
Never would sense that they were the thing... that they were the book, definitely not a heroic level. I mean, those were just gag books, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right. So back in 1976, a 29-year-old stuntman, or alleged stuntman, there's going to be a lot of alleged in this, named Rick Rojat, emerged from Montreal, allegedly Rick Rojat, emerged from Montreal, Quebec, calling himself the Human Fly, and already behind that red and white mask. As we were saying, the mid-70s were a high point for stuntmen in general. And the Fly tried to distinguish himself by wing-walking on a low-flying DC-8 over the Mojave Desert in June 1976. Then he did it again the next day, and that time he was knocked unconscious by the rain because, he was going 250 miles an hour, and that probably hurt. So this real life Fly, he was a lot less modest than the comic book Fly, going by his various magazine and TV interviews. He seemed to take particular care to take pot shots at the king of the stuntmen, at the time, Evel Knievel himself. He had a real problem with Evel Knievel. He promised, the human Fly promised he was going to be bigger, more successful, and more popular than the already world-renowned Daredevil. In one interview, I think it was in People magazine, it was in People magazine, said Rojat, a Canadian, says he was once a Hollywood stuntman, although the California Union has no record of him. He also says he was in an auto accident in North Carolina 6 years ago, which killed his wife and four-year-old daughter and badly injured him. He had 38 operations in 4 years, he says, which allowed him to walk again, but left him with a body that is 60% steel parts. He says he conditions himself by rising at 3 a.m., running 6 miles, and then plunging into a bathtub full of ice cubes.
But do you know what else happened 6 years earlier?
What was that?
D.B. Cooper jumped out of an airplane. Mm-hmm. How are you going to break 60% of your body? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll win you over to this crazy theory.
Yeah, and that, and he had enough money for a costume and a motorcycle, so, you know, that had to come from somewhere.
I'll drop that eventually. But.
but of course, caveats galore here. The human Fly appeared to be sponsored by a sausage maker, Joe Ramazzieri, who ran his family business. I'm going to butcher this. I'm sorry, Siskoid. Le Aliment Roma in Montreal. Joined by his brother Dominic, Joe wanted to do more than smoke meats and figured that the stunt tread would be his ticket. And that is really all anyone is really sure about. After that, things get pretty murky. By some accounts, Rick Rojat was not a mostly metal stuntman who clawed his way back from the brink, but rather a Ramazzieri employee who was willing to risk his life for a little fame and fortune. Joel Ramazzieri says his crew were the ones who approached Marvel with the idea of a comic, and Marvel, being willing to jump on any potential trend it could license at the time, took the bait. In other accounts, Marvel approached them. In any case, Marvel ran with it. The Human Fly was already getting lots of press for his DC-8 stunt, not to mention his repeated claims of plans for jumping off Toronto's CN Tower in 20 feet of water, and eventually flying across the English Channel from England to France strapped to a rocket. He was a staple of the American TV show That's Incredible, which, you know, if you're younger, you might not remember it. I do. And Canada's Headline Hunters. Yeah, I mean, That's Incredible. He'd even appeared in character. This was new to me. I found this out researching this. He was in character in the TV movie The Beach Boys, It's Okay, which also featured John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. So,
what?
Yeah. So he is in a Beach Boys movie with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. Yeah. So, you know, the human fly... tailor-made for Marvel. Okay. In another weirdo twist of fate, a pre-celebrity Cyndi Lauper apparently used to run the checks back and forth between Ramazzieri and the Marvel offices. Then, in the early 80s, Lauper's then boyfriend, David Wolfe, and you might remember him, would perform at a New Jersey concert as the lead singer of The Human Fly and Red Rider, another effort underwritten by Ramazzieri, who himself dreamed of being a musician. So Ramazzieri's dreams and his hopes and Rick Rojat's tendency to bend the truth, a lot of that eventually found its way into the Marvel comic. But before any of that could happen, Marvel had to get The Human Fly number one out first. That issue would feature a story based very loosely on the wing-walking gag over the Mojave Desert. Only now, the story would involve magnet gloves, a dangerous thunderstorm, a jet copter, would-be hijacker the mercenary, and special guest Spider-Man. Bill Mantlo wrote a column in that same issue explaining the concept, which was probably a good idea because this really kind of came out of left field. And people were probably wondering what the whole Because He's Real thing was about. A later issue would also feature photos of the human fly, the real human fly, and his sidekick Mercury, who wasn't a character in the comics, kicking around the Marvel offices with Jim Shooter, who by that time would be the publisher's editor-in-chief. So for 19 issues, Mantlo spun his usual gold out of the thinnest straw. But just as the fantastic universe of Marvel superheroes was injected into the real-life human fly stunts, other aspects were wisely ignored.
So with Mantlo writing it, it's kind of fascinating to me that Rick Rojat has such a perfectly alliterative Marvel name, and yet right? It was never used in the book. It sounds like something Mantlo would have come up with as homage to Stan Lee's naming conventions.
It really does. And the thing is, one thing that's interesting about Rojat is he apparently came out of nowhere. and then as we'll explain later, kind of disappears back into that same nowhere. It's a lot of it is very I hate to use the word suspicious, but it's very suspect, I guess, is what. Well, I don't know. I don't know how to explain it, because so much of it could be completely fake. But Marvel has never. I mean, because if Marvel had done that, that would be an amazing bit of marketing, and I would think that they would like to brag about that a little bit. But they have always said that was, you know, that for a long time they didn't even know who he was. It was only a few years ago, I think, that Jim Shooter actually finally said, yes, that was Rick Rojat. For all I know, Joe Ramaseri he could have just made up that name, you know, because as sure. We were talking about, there was apparently Joe Ramaseri also came up with the idea of having multiple human flies making appearances across the country. Basically at the same time, he was basically franchising it the way you would franchise Ronald McDonald. For all we know, there is no Rick Rojat.
Exactly. And that's truly fascinating. I mean, reading about it, it does seem, you know, some people that have looked at, you know, VHS tapes or beta tapes of on-air appearances and still photos mm-hmm. claim that the part of his mouth that you can see looks different at different times. And that sounds like that could be falling into conspiracy territory, which is why I was sort of layering in the D.B. Cooper thing earlier, to be honest.
Right.
Or it could be that, yes, there were, in fact, just like you could go to a mall in Texas and I can go to a mall in Kentucky and we could go both get Spider-Man's signature, but it was not the same dude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's going to the mall to see Santa Claus. We don't know. Yeah, you know, we don't know who's behind the beard. But yeah, and so, and even if there was a Rick Rojat, he apparently already had a reputation as, you know, I don't want to use the L word, but let's say he told tall tales, you know, because yes. Apparently he used to tell a story himself about having a lot of surgeries. And that he had metal plates in his body, but the story he told was that he had those surgeries because he was beaten nearly to death by a menstruating gorilla. So that's a story to tell.
Which, you know, is a common ailment, more common in the 70s.
Happens to everybody. It's totally sure. Believable. Yeah. I've heard that once. I've heard it a million times.
It's interesting too, he says Hollywood stuntman, because right. Really the Canadian film industry was not lacking at the time, so if he's Canadian, I'm a little hazy on why he wasn't doing CDC or CBC productions or
mm-hmm.
I don't know, there are just some gaps there that don't seem to fill in, and it sounds like the more people research it, the larger the gaps get, or right. At least the more Swiss cheese appears. And the, you know, he's one of those people who, the longer you talk to them, not that I've spoken to him obviously, but the less it seems like their life can fit into the container that you're given for most people's lives.
Right. And, you know, and as we mentioned earlier, you know, People Magazine ran us because he was. A little bit of a sensation for a few months there, and sure. People Magazine did an article about him. But you know, as we said, the California Stunt Union didn't have any record of him, so they didn't know what that was about. There were rumors that he was on the run from the mob, which is why he didn't take off his mask. But that's also considered that maybe Joe Ramaseri himself had come up with that story just to kind of add some spice to things. And you know, but the thing is, at the time, you know, stuntmen were a thing, and also no one cared enough to really look that deeply into it. It's interesting how, you know, as you say, if you just do even a little bit of digging, you start finding all these gaps and all these stories that don't line up and don't make sense. But no one really cared. I think people just wanted to see the next guy launch himself, you know, across a canyon.
Sure. When I was 6 years old, I just thought it was cool.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't have deep thoughts around that. I keep thinking about the 19 issue run and how the 19th issue really does correspond with the collapse of the comics industry in 1978.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if it was a factor of his star had burned out. Marvel didn't want to pay licensing and were trying to jettison anything that cost them money that wasn't making money, or if it was just the result of that mid-late summer collapse that we always put heavily on DC, but Marvel had the same amount of cuts. They just didn't precede it by promising to triple the size of their line.
Right. You know, it's an interesting, yeah, there was no Marvel implosion, but, just got a Marvel, you know.
Right. But they did cut their line basically in half at the same time DC.
Yeah.
Went up theirs by like 80%.
Right. Well, you know, getting back to Rick Rojat, this is what ended things for him. And there is some overlap in October 1977, which is also the publication date of The Human Flight Number 2. Rick Rojat and the Romissary folks decided they were going to push Evel Knievel aside. They really had a thing for Evel Knievel. Knievel had jumped 13 buses at Wembley Stadium 2 years ago, which was a big deal. I mean, I remember that. And if anyone wonders where jumping the shark comes from, you know, why Fonzie had to jump a shark, that's because people were just jumping everything in those days.
Sure.
Yeah. And so Rojat wanted to triple it. He wanted to jump 36 buses, which is a hell of a lot of buses. The engineer they approached to build the rocket
cycle. It's not a small number of buses.
No, it's not a small number of buses at all. So the engineer that they found to build the rocket cycle told him he was nuts. He told him that there's no way that was going to work. And he managed to talk him down to 26 buses, which is still an outrageous number. That is still, you know.
Absolutely.
It's crazy. But they decided to go ahead and go for it. So in October of 77, the stage was set for disaster. The Human Fly was performing as the opening act before a Gloria Gaynor concert. And the state, which is, you know, this, I say these things out loud and they sound demented.
that detail is so beautiful. What the hell does Gloria Gaynor and disco have to do with jumping over buses?
And you have to think
on a rocket cycle.
Yes, and you have to think that Gloria Gaynor would be able to say, yes, I met the Human Fly. Because I assume that happened at some point. It just rattles my whole head. But anyway, this was, disco was on the down slope at this point already. So the stadium was almost empty. Okay. The rocket cycle was untested and the ramps were poorly constructed. And the engineer who went to go check on the bike before the stunt saw these ramps and tried to tell them that they wouldn't do it, that they shouldn't do it. But no one wanted to listen to him. And he also said that the fly looked like he might've been drunk or high before getting on the motorcycle. So basically every single thing you could hope to put into place to make this not go well, with the exception of Gloria Gaynor, I have no problem with Gloria Gaynor, but everything else was just set up to make this a disaster. So the Human Fly took his place at the end of the ramp. He revved his Harley Davidson XL 1000 Sportster, which is, if you know, it's a pretty muscular bike. And he hit the switch on his two hydrogen peroxide boosters that were mounted under the gas tank. And now this motorcycle, which normally had a top speed of 130 miles per hour, had the potential to go 300 miles per hour. So you have this Harley Davidson shooting up this ramp, and almost immediately the stunt goes bad. If you've ever seen video, and I'll post a link to it, but as soon as he leaves the ramp, the cycle begins to nose up, and it looks like, almost looks like the bike is going to make a complete just spin on its axis. And somewhere around the 19th bus, the Human Fly crashes right into the line of buses with the motorcycle landing on top of him. It is a horrific looking crash. Amazingly, Rojat survived. And as they were taking him out of the stadium on a stretcher, he even manages to give us thumbs up on the way out. That was the last time anyone ever saw or heard of Rick Rojat or the real life Human Fly again.
But you know what? He beat Evel Knievel's record.
He did.
He didn't make the jump all the way, but he beat the record.
Yeah. God bless him. He beat that record by about 6 buses. So let's hear it for Rick Rojat. But, you know, as I said, after that, he just disappeared. If Joe Ramancieri knows what became of him, he never said. As quickly as the human fly came onto the scene, he was gone. He left behind a handful of video clips. The inspiration for an as yet uncompleted documentary. There is a documentary in the works, but it's been in the works, I think, since 2012. So, you know, we live in hope.
The last update I could find, which I'm sure is what you read as well, was like 2017, and they were thinking about shifting it to a theatrical.
Right, exactly. But you know, that's it comes and goes. You know, sometimes there's talk about this, and it's the same people, you know, who are behind it, and they work on it, and they announce something, and then it kind of fades away, and then it comes back. Keep your fingers crossed that might never get completed. But beyond those film clips, and there's some clips of him, of the human fly speaking on talk shows and that sort of thing, I've done online searches until my eyes crossed that I've never been able to find a phone number or an address or you know, luckily, an obituary. I've never found anything like that for Rick Rojat. So beyond those clips, the only thing we have left of the human fly is this 19-issue run of comics. Like all good stories, Rick Rojat and the real-life human fly is still a mystery. Do you think we'll ever know the real story behind all this?
And
do we even want to?
And I'm not sure we do. And I keep circling back to D.B. Cooper because that is a story without an answer. The hunt for the answer is the fascination. That's the piece that captures the imagination most. And every documentarian that's worked on who D.B. Cooper was feels like they got close but couldn't quite say definitively.
Right.
I think the people working on Human Fly, who was a much lesser figure in that 70s landscape but still significant, probably is resulting in the same challenge. You know, many of the principals are going to have passed away at this point.
Mm-hmm.
If there was anything mob related going on, that's not something people are going to be exceedingly forthcoming about.
Strangely enough,
for instance, if that stunt was an effort to collect insurance money on him as opposed to really supporting the stunt, which is a potential theory put forth by the engineer who had designed the rocket. He isn't too forthcoming about it, but you don't have to read between too many lines to see that that's his opinion of it.
Mm-hmm. That engineer also says at one point in one interview that he asked Mercury what his specialty was, and the answer was, "I make concrete shoes." And again, I don't know how much of this is people just kind of talking, you know, or trying to make their story more interesting, or what's real. And I think that, like you said, that's one of the things that I think really just makes this, and it sounds weird because we're talking about real people, but this is what kind of makes it fun for me.
There's not an objective, definitive narrator for this. There's not a fully trustworthy person who saw all of it.
No, this story is nothing but unreliable narrators. And even reading and listening to, because there are taped interviews out there, and, you know, trying to piece this all together, I am no closer to an answer than I was when I first picked up an issue of The Human Fly. I don't know any more. Well, that's not true. I know more details, but those details shed absolutely no light on this backstory at all. I kind of love about it.
Yeah. And it hasn't been mined as much as other populist heroes with the attached mystery were in the 70s. There weren't a multitude of books trying to figure it out. There was, as you said, only this comic book series, which is not pure fiction, but it's certainly from the mind of Bill Mantlow more than it is from the archives of Rick Rojak's hidden memoirs.
Which is probably for the better, because sure. You know, Mantlo's stories are, you know, it's pure Mantlo. You know, they're a lot of fun. It's a virtuous hero who's trying to do the best he can. His friends who stick up for him, and you know, that's one of the things I like. And we'll get more into this after we start talking about the comic. But one of the things I like about the comic character is that he has no super abilities. His biggest ability is to see the potential in other people and to encourage that. You know, and that is his entire mission. That's his whole thing. He doesn't want to be, he never wants to be a hero. He just wants to do good. And, you know, and I find that exceptionally charming.
It is. And I think that's a nice bit of self-promotion and actually shows a solid understanding of why superheroes can work and why there's a positivity and optimism present through a lot of characters in the medium that he seems to have understood, assuming he lent some of those foundational ideas to the people of Marvel.
So Patrick, what is your theory as far as who the real life Human Fly was?
I think that there was somebody whose reach exceeded his grasp. Mm-hmm. How does that saying go?
His reach exceeded his grasp. Yeah.
Yeah. So he had a lot of really great ideas, but didn't really know how to execute them or how to fully plan for every aspect of it. So I think he was swept up by the showbiz part and didn't think, say, riding a motorcycle across a canyon and then crashing really took a particular talent. Mm-hmm. I think he miscalculated on the talent and ambition and training aspect of things.
Right.
So in some ways, in this comic, one of the characters, the adversarial journalist, calls him a glory seeker. And I mm-hmm. think that's true to a degree.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that's true of Joel Ramenceri, too. I think he basically found someone to do the things he wasn't willing to do himself. He and whoever, you know, Rojat or whoever was under the mask. I think they saw it as an opportunity to become rich and famous, but you know, which is something that everyone has always wanted to do since time immemorial. And there's a bittersweetness to this story. You know, they never quite reached the upper limits that they were shooting for. And this kind of stopped for them.
Why do you think the high level of anonymity there, though? As you said, you compared the cock mask more to a Luchador mask, and I hadn't thought of it in those terms. I was definitely thinking wrestling. His cape is evocative of Elvis of the time. Everything about him was sort of a visual remix of wrestling superheroes and Elvis. And of course, Elvis was influenced by superheroes too, so it all makes sense. There's a bombast about him. So he nailed the showmanship part.
Yeah, I don't know if the anonymity was just really clever marketing, or if it was a practicality. You know, going back to Ramenceri saying that, you know, basically anyone could, human flies could be a dime a dozen. You know, that he could always replace whoever was the human fly, and he couldn't do that unless, you know, it was the mask and not the person underneath it. That is a very good question, because I am not sure if it was happenstance, it was just a lucky coincidence, or if it was really that well thought out.
I don't think it follows the pattern of, say, the I believe French Spider-Man that climbed the Eiffel Tower, where you may have people doing things anonymously because what they're doing isn't technically legal, or they're not, you know, they didn't get permits or licenses to do something totally nuts, because his thing was geared more for a professional paid gig. I mean, if he's opening for Gloria Gaynor, he's not just like, hey, I'm going to go climb this thing I shouldn't be on.
It's strange. And again, this kind of goes back to us talking about what a trend stunts were. You know, I mean, it was a big thing for, I don't know, what, 2-3 years maybe? I mean, there were movies, and there was, you know, there was Hooper and Stunt Rock and, you know, all those sorts of things. And I had the Evel Knievel wind-up motorcycle thing, you know, and it was a huge deal, you know? And
it was.
Yeah, you know, and I don't know if they saw a quick buck or if they saw a real future for this. And it, you know, I would love to be able to find out the answer to that. Let's go to some promos, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about the Human Fly number one.
Do you think of yourself primarily as a singer or as a poet?
Well, I think of myself more as a song and dance man, you know.
You may call him Alias. You may call him Lucky Wilbury. You may call him Bobby. You may call him Zimmy. But the world calls him Bob Dylan. It's Pod Dylan, the only podcast dedicated to celebrating the work of Bob Dylan. Pod Dylan, hosted by the freewheeling Rob Kelly and a roster of special guests, examines Bob Dylan's discography one song at a time. Proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, Pod Dylan is available weekly at fireandwaterpodcast.com and on iTunes and Stitcher. Forever young.
Space, the final frontier. These are the recordings of the podcast Gimme That Star Trek. Its ongoing mission, to explore all of Star Trek, to seek out new guests and new opinions, to boldly go where many have gone before.
Gimme That Star Trek. A new episode every month, only at fireandwaterpodcast.com and on iTunes.
And welcome back. Again, we are here with Patrick Joseph talking about the Human Fly number one. This issue is titled Death Walk. It's written by Bill Mantlo, drawn by Lee Elias. Joe Rosen was the letterer. Marie Severin is the colorist. And Archie Goodwin is the editor.
I love that credits box.
Yes. No, it's great. And actually, I love that. And we'll see this in other issues. But every issue has a title, and it has, you know, for a licensed comic. And again, you know, I have to give a lot of credit. Well, to Marvel in general, but Bill Mantlo really knows how to sell the sizzle, because really, there would be no reason for anyone to put this much effort into into this comic, but they do. You know, I don't pick up any issue of the Human Fly and think, oh, well, that was a terrible comic.
No. And Archie Goodwin is editor. He had just come over from DC not long ago, where he had written Unknown Soldier for about a year or so. Mm-hmm. He, of course, wrote Manhunter at Warren. He had produced one of the greatest war series of all time, Blazing Combat. He was already a legend, and he's editing Human Fly.
Right.
Joe Rosen, whose lettering ends up gracing Frank Miller and Klaus Janson's run on Daredevil just a couple of years later. Marie mm-hmm. Severin, of course, had been around since the 50s. Lee Elias, right. Also a classic artist who, although not a superstar at this point by any means, is a very, very solid storyteller. And whether you are a fan of his art or not familiar with it, it gets across the point. I of course love him for Ultra the Multi-Alien.
Yeah, exactly. And well, and Lee Elias, I mean, there are some other artists as the series goes on, but he is the closest thing to a regular artist on the Human Fly. And sure. And he is actually personally my favorite artist on this run. He just really seems to kind of get it. It's muscular. It's athletic. It's acrobatic. Nothing seems out of bounds in terms of the physicality of it. And everyone just looks great. Everyone has, their own facial expressions. And, you know, it's really well done, I think.
Yeah, I think the four well, five leads, I think the journalist recurs also, are all very well done and distinctive. I'd like to back up to the cover for 1 second.
Yeah. No, please.
The cover, standard action montage, the human fly without his cape for some reason, but is grasping some sort of ornate gold staff.
Right.
We don't know what that has to do with anything. The one place you'd think he'd use it would be walking on a tightrope across what we could assume were the Niagara Falls, which does become a plot point in your issue. But he's also beating the hell out of a shark with it. Standing rock solid like a Jack Kirby drawing, beating on a shark with this gold staff.
Yep.
What exactly? I love misleading covers where it's like this scene appears nowhere in this issue.
No, but it will be in a different issue. And a lot of these things are, I guess you could consider it kind of a preview, because you know in this one he does hang from the helicopter. Let me break it down. I love this cover. I really love this cover. I mean, if I had seen this on the stands, you know, with the human fly just kind of bursting out of the middle of the cover, holding onto that baton with this serious look on his face and that red and white costume with a rocket on his belt, which I've never really quite understood. But, you know, whatever, I would have eaten it up right then. But, you know, going clockwise, he's smacking a shark in the face. He's standing on top of a jet. He's crossing a high wire in front of what looks like Niagara Falls, and he's hanging from a helicopter. Two of those things happen in this comic. And the rest of it happens later. But yeah, it's a beautiful cover. I love this cover. Yeah. And it's a black background, so that red really pops out of there. Human fly.
It would draw my attention.
Yeah.
It would show up in ads from Heroes World for years, where you could buy a 4-pack of Marvel first issues, and Fly was often in that ad. And I only read one actual issue of Human Fly as a kid, number 11, maybe. I don't know why I remember that. But seeing this cover again and again in Heroes World catalog ads for probably 2 or 3 years, it just was really iconic for me. So they knew they had something with it, even though the series was defunct. That or they just had so many extra copies of it that they just couldn't give them away.
Yeah, and I need to check, but I believe this is an Elias cover, isn't it?
I'm not positive. I meant to look at Grand Comics Database or Mike's Amazing World, and I forgot. It sort of reminds me vaguely of Dave Cockrum, but it isn't, I don't think.
Right. In any case, it's a great cover. And there's a little there's a little burst.
Maybe Elias Wyasak.
Oh, maybe. Could be. And I love at the bottom, there's some text here that says, "From the shadow of the grave, he rose to become the greatest death defier of them all." And, you know, it's gold. The story itself goes back to that DC-8 stunt over the Mojave. Except now it's a 747. It's a lightning streaked sky, and there are hijackers.
It's in Houston.
It's in the skies above Houston. Yeah. Let me describe the human fly, I guess, first, because we kind of went over it, but not really. So the human fly wears a mostly red costume with white stripes across the face. And kind of it is kind of like a luchador mask. Sometimes he wears like a half cape. He has a belt with a big white belt with a rocket on it. And he carries that baton. For some reason, to me, all of that really works.
It kind of references wrestling the same way Superman's outfit referenced the outfit of a bodybuilder of the time.
The strongman costume. Yeah.
Strongman trunks and such. So it really is very much of the visual of its time for someone that's in kind of a carnival adjacent profession.
Right. Yeah. And that belt is definitely, it looks like a wrestler's championship belt, because I cannot imagine that's practical as a stuntman. I mean, you're going to cut yourself in half with that thing, but it looks really good.
Absolutely.
And I think it serves the character well, you know, because it is, you know, for a superhero who doesn't necessarily want to be a superhero, but is still a performer of some kind, you can buy the idea that he would wear this costume and even why he wears the mask all the time without having to have necessarily the trappings of the standard superhero origin. Because, you know, he does lose in this comic, you know, we do get his origin. We get the origin of actually three of the characters. And he does lose his wife and his children. I think it says multiple children in a car accident, the same accident that injures him. But he doesn't become a stuntman or anything like that out of an idea of justice or vengeance or anything like that. You know, he basically goes through this tragedy and decides, I was able to lift myself up out of this tragedy that I've had to go through and this physical pain and limitations that I had to go through. And I want other people to know that as bad as things look, they can get better. And I think that is just such a breath of fresh air for a hero origin.
I agree, except with one piece of the execution.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, there's no introduction or sense of the wife and child or children being real.
Right.
It's mentioned as a past tense event. And I don't necessarily want the book to have spent 3 to 10 panels on, well, maybe I did want to some sort of establishment of these as people and not just ciphers in his background. So it loses some of its emotional impact because you don't see him with the wife and child say like, oh, we're driving to go see the Mark of Zorro today. And then the car blew up.
No, and you know, but that's a good point because you never see his wife and children. You never see them. His origin starts with a car crashing into a tree.
Yeah, and there were certainly many, many superheroes who started off with a tragedy, whether intentional or accidental. Maybe it's the accidental nature. Maybe it's the wanting to maintain the illusion of the personal story that this may have been what actually happened to him. And as such, it would seem kind of like rubbernecking someone's tragedy.
Right. Well, I guess they didn't want to go with the menstruating gorilla.
It was another 6 or 7 years before a code approved. Oh, no, it wasn't even code approved. But before a newsstand comic mentioned menstruation at all, much less gorilla. It was a menstruating werewolf. But.
Yeah. No, but that's, you know, that is a good point because it is sort of. What is important is not his family that he lost, but the accident itself.
Right.
And I think that kind of gives short shrift to. I mean, you do see what's important to the human fly, you know, in this one and in other issues, but it's never in that context. It's always in the context of I overcame something. And I want to give people the hope that they can overcome something too. But yeah, but it's kind of without depth.
Mantlo mentions it almost in more depth in his introductory column than he does in the actual content of the story.
Right. And let's talk about that story real quick.
Yes.
So the story opens with the human fly hanging upside down from a jet copter, because of course it has to be a jet copter, because they are flying over a speeding 747. And the story is it's a little interesting because it goes into flashback half the time, I would say. But what we see now is the human fly trying to use magnetic clamps in his gloves to hold onto the jet. He's fighting the wind and the rain, while above, stunt engineer Ted Locke struggles to brace a bar holding the fly, while pilot Blaze Kendall fights the weather, trying to match the 747 speed. The fly's life is in their hands. And this is when we get our first flashback. It's the human fly. He's being interviewed by a suspicious Harmony White, who is a TV journalist. And when they get the news that the press plane has been hijacked by someone named the Mercenary. We have never seen the Mercenary before, and we will never see him again. But the mercenary says, nope. And that happens a lot in this series. what the mercenary wants is $5 million and safe passage to Mexico.
And, may I point out something?
Yeah.
$5 million is a lot of money in 1977.
Yeah.
And
for it's even more in Mexico. Yeah.
Yeah. And I did a little research. It is a 5-hour drive from Houston to the Mexican border. I feel like there may have been a more effective way for them. If all they wanted to do really was get to Mexico and have a little cash on hand, they could have found a better approach.
I'm sure there's gas stations on the way that they could have knocked over.
Yeah, yeah. $5 million, they buy a couple of cars with cash. They've still got $4,990,000 left. After gas, I did look up gas prices also.
Well, you know, and their plan is not the best plan, because what they say they'll do if they don't get the $5 million is they'll basically circle around the city until it runs out of fuel and crashes into Houston. So yeah. I hope everyone packed a parachute. What they don't know is that on the on this press plane is not only your random reporters and photographers, but also Peter Parker. Peter Parker, that name might be familiar. Back on the ground, realizing that the hijackers are serious, I'm not really sure how he knows they're serious, the human fly springs into action. Blaze and Ted continue to struggle with their tasks, with Blade asking Ted if he has any idea what rain feels like at 300 miles per hour. As if on cue, below, the fly loses his grips and his magnet clamps are slipping.
That actually happened. The 300 miles an hour in the rain was based on a real event. So you have these little punctuations of reality intruding on this fictional narrative.
Exactly, which I think is just really so interesting about this comic and this character. You know, there are hints of real life in these comics, but they're so, you know, they're obviously wrapped up in these comic book fantasies. You're selling comic books, but yeah, you start looking into the real life human fly and you can see where the germs of these stories might have been picked up. On the DC-8, he was going 250 miles an hour in a mild rainstorm, and that was enough to knock him unconscious.
Well, and Bill Mantlo's good at taking little kernels and running with it. I mean, he did get 75 issues and 4 annuals out of ROM, and that was a plastic toy with almost zero backstory.
Right, and no articulation.
Right, exactly. So he had a little more to work with here.
Exactly. And, you know, and I love these secondary characters. The human fly is basically joined by 3 people. He's joined by an engineer, Ted Locke, Blaze Kendall, the pilot, which I mentioned, and Arnie Berman, who is his publicist. And Harmony White, who we've also mentioned, will kind of become the reporter from the Incredible Hulk TV series. She's just basically going to she's going to follow him around the country, hounding him because she cannot believe someone can be so selfless, essentially. And she is promising her editor that she is going to bust this wide open.
The cast reminded me of another comic book. And it's a comic book that came out 7 years earlier that was about a stuntman, Mr. Miracle. And I think there are some slight parallels in the cast lineup to Orion, Shiloh Norman, and Big Barda.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Not totally shocking, because Mantlo did sort of bring in some new gods concepts into the first 12 issues of Micronauts also. So I think that he had a huge affection for the fourth world stuff. I don't think it's overt. It might not be fully a conscious move on his part, but I think that that kind of arrangement for the stuntman support team was in the back of his head from Mr. Miracle, possibly.
Yeah, that's interesting. It also reminded me a little bit of the Warriors 3. From Thor.
Oh.
In the sense that, you know, he had this kind of like support team, you know, behind him. You know, Thor was, you know, the obvious hero, but he also leaned a lot on the Warriors 3. And this kind of reminded me of that also.
That's a really good point. I like that.
Yeah. So in our second flashback, I'm already losing count. We see Blaze Kendall. She's an airline co-pilot. And she's watching in horror as the captain suffers a heart attack, and he collapses and pushes the plane into a nosedive. Blaze manages to crash land the plane saving everyone on board. And it's the artwork on that crash is just bone shaking. I mean, it is a wonderful drawing. But she is severely injured. But what's hurt the most is her self-confidence. She has already basically given up on ever flying again. One night while she's in the hospital, she's visited by a mysterious man who tells her she can't give up and that he needs her for his mission. And we'll see this happen again later on in the same comic. So back in the present, Blaze is newly inspired by the fly's belief in her, and she matches the speed of the jetliner below.
She is a unexpected feminist icon in this. Mm-hmm. You think about a black woman in the 70s being the co-pilot of an airplane and not the stewardess. That's kind of amazing for this time period. And they don't make a big deal out of it. They don't call out, hey, this woman of color is doing a white dude's job.
Right.
In fact, I almost feel bad pointing it out because they just ran it in there without pointing any arrows at that, that information.
Yeah.
So she starts out very much just as a strong, confident feminist character without there being anything to it other than the human fly inspiring her to be who she already is.
That continues throughout the series. I mean, continues in this book as well, but it's throughout the entire series. Blaze is just a highly competent person.
Absolutely. You know,
being a black woman is incidental almost to her competence.
That's the word I was striving for when I was.
Yeah, yes. And I love Blaze. I think she is probably one of my favorite characters in this series.
She's really strong right off the bat.
Yeah. So she's able to match the speed of the jetliner, which enables the fly to clamp onto the plane, but he's still being shaken apart by the bar that he's holding onto. Above him, Ted is gripping the bar with his prosthetic hooks. He does not have hands. And Ted is almost falling out of the chopper in the process. And he even says, if I fail now, the fly dies. And we get yet another flashback. And this time, and this is also, this flashback will kind of put a finger on the time that we're talking about here. Because we see Ted as a military engineer who's about to blow up a bridge during the Vietnam War. He sees a woman and her child crossing the bridge, and he runs out there desperately to warn them. And, you know, it's actually interesting because in the story, we don't know if he actually saves them or not. We do know, though, that his own hand, he loses his hands in the explosion.
He does save them?
If
you look at the panel very closely, they are on the other side of the bridge at the point that he's flying through the air.
You are right. Yeah, they're ducked down from the explosion. Yeah, so he does manage to save the woman and her child. Yeah, go Ted.
Yeah.
But you know, he does lose his hands in the process, and he is despondent because he sees this as the end of his career, and a career that seemed to be wide open. It's mentioned that Tony Stark himself was interested in him, but Ted is just, he doesn't see how he could be an engineer without his hands. He is also visited by a mysterious man who tells him that his own skeleton has been almost entirely replaced with steel replacements. So I think we know who this mystery man is. And he says that he believes in Ted, and he wants him, that he has more to share with the world, and he just wants Ted to give him a chance to prove it. Back in the present time, Ted stabilizes the bar, and that gives the fly the chance to flip onto the roof of the jetliner, and using his baton for balance, he begins the slow walk to the front of the 747. Inside the plane, the hijackers hear his steps, and Peter Parker, you know, his spider sense goes off. And the mercenary starts shooting just into the roof of the plane, and almost hits the fly, who's swept off the plane. Arnie Berman and Harmony White can only watch in shock from the ground as the human fly falls from the plane. But he quickly switches off the magnet clamps and powers the auxiliary jets in his boots and gloves, and he rockets towards the jet and clings to the wing flap for dear life. So the fly has a ton of gadgets on him already, yes. You know, that I guess you could kind of say you would see that being used for his stunts. And they just happen to also be extremely helpful when you are trying to stop a bunch of hijackers in the middle of the midair.
Sure.
Why not? He's Marvel's Batman. He's always prepared. And so this is when we get what I think is our last flashback, and this is about the Human Fly himself. And so we see his accident. We learn about his multiple injuries and his very slow recovery. He is basically told that he will never walk again. He, of course, is devastated by this at first, but then he decides that he is not going to accept that. And he goes from dragging himself from his bed to the floor to, being able to stand and walk. And he's doing this all under the cover of night. He's doing this himself because I guess the medical staff gave up on him already, to lifting chairs and eventually acrobatics, which, I couldn't even do on my best day.
No, I was doing some physical therapy last year, and the squat one is about the only thing in here.
Exactly.
Just leaping in the air and touching his toes simultaneously. Keeping his back straight. Like, what's going on here? I love this montage, though. I like panels, used sparingly, but panels, single panels that have multiple images. Mm-hmm. As opposed to panel borders. And there are 9 distinct images in this one panel, and it just reads beautifully. I think Lee Elias did a really good job with laying this one out and showing the time lapse that way very effectively.
Yeah, he really does. And you can see the struggle and the advancement that he makes, because it gets pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last image, he's trying to stand up using a chair to brace himself on. And in the last one, he's doing a full-on handstand. He is his own best physiotherapist. And so once he's up and walking around, that's when he makes the promise to himself that he's going to be a living example that disabilities don't mean a person can't lead a useful and fulfilling life, and that he wants to give hope to those who feel hopeless. That's when he decides he's going to become the Human Fly.
Hey, is this Marvel's only Marvel's second explicitly disabled character? And is it also the only one that did not have superhero powers to supplement their... Basically, I'm talking about Daredevil.
I would think so. Because, he doesn't... The Fly doesn't get any superhuman strength or anything like that from his surgeries. He basically just kind of puts himself into peak condition to be able to do that in spite of his injuries. I wouldn't think so. Again, the only one I can think of is Donald Blake, but even then, he taps his stick and he becomes Thor and he's not lame anymore. I think so. I mean, I can't think of anyone offhand.
So he did this purely by force of will.
Because I mean, the only other one I can think of is maybe Doctor Strange, but even then...
It's still magic.
Yeah.
You still can't do surgery.
And that's one of the things I like about this character, is that he is very human. And as we'll see in other issues too, he is not so egotistical that he says, I'm going to stay here and fight this, when he knows that he's outclassed. He'll go like, I'm going to go somewhere else now because, this is going to put me and other people in danger for no reason. I'm going to try and help out in a different way. And I like that. I like that because I think that is for good or ill, that is how most people would react to a lot of situations, I think, especially where, your life is in danger. Or someone else's life is in danger. You could stand there and fight, or you can save the person. You can save the innocent people who are in that room with you. And the Human Fly always chooses to save the innocents.
Let Ghost Rider deal with the rest of it.
Exactly. Back on the plane, in his own little utility belt, the Fly has a small explosive charge, and he blows the door on the jet. So this jet is basically just full of holes now. He quickly jumps in and just starts wailing on the mercenaries gang. He even says, he goes, it's going to take all my skill and all my ability to, and he knows that he has the element of surprise and he's going to use it. In the confusion, Peter Parker ducks away and changes into a costume. And now we finally see the Amazing Spider-Man. So together they both make quick work of the henchmen, and the mercenary decides he's had enough and he's going to use a jetpack that he has to make his escape out the same door that the Fly came in through. But just before he does, the human fly dives onto him and they both fall out of the plane. The mercenary has tries to shake the fly off and then begins shooting at him as they're jetting wildly through the sky. Spider-Man jumps out using a webbing up a hang glider to follow the two.
I would like to point out, though, the panel where the fly is gripping one of the legs of the mercenary whose jetpack is blasting downward while he's firing up in a purely vertical panel over the cityscape of Houston. And it's really a nice use of that space. And it's an unusual panel design.
It is. That's a nice long panel that goes from the top to the bottom of the page. Yeah. And it just has a real fluidity to it. It kind of gives you a perspective of a falling in the sky. Basically, they're free falling toward Houston. And you really get that sense of it by watching that. Yeah. And also how much danger the fly is in, not just from falling out of a jumbo jet, but also from the mercenary who is basically shooting at him from point blank range.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, there's a lot of it's a very dynamic panel. So yeah, Spider-Man decides to follow on a hang glider that he webs up and sees the human fly knock the mercenary out with a single punch. Unfortunately, he also gets some of the jetpacks backwash in his face, and that makes him lose his grip and he starts to fall. Spider-Man lets go of his glider and gets close enough to shoot a web to the human fly, who grabs it as Spidey whips out a webbed parachute. The two of them float down to an empty stadium where the unconscious mercenary has managed to land or crash, and the jet copter is also there waiting. Spider-Man leaves quickly so he can get back on the plane before anyone misses him in his identity as Peter Parker, but not before thinking to himself, "Welcome to the hero business, Fly, and good luck." The city tries to give the fly some reward money for stopping the hijackers, but he tells them to give it to charity, asking only for enough to cover the crew's expenses. Get ready for some downtime. The human fly and his faithful friends leave, while cynical reporter Harmony White wonders if the fly is too good to be true and promises to expose him if it's the last thing she does. That's the end.
I feel so bad for his publicist, because he isn't called out by name until that last panel in his own is about being his agent. So he gets two panels out of the whole book. I had to read it a couple of times to make sure I didn't miss flashback Barney,
where he had
some, you know, tragic Hollywood thing, and you know, where maybe all of his hair burned off, but then he got an orange perm and that somehow saved him and confidence again.
Well, Arnie does get a whole origin in a later issue, but yeah, he's kind of done dirty in this issue because he's not mentioned by name until the very end. He has a couple of lines, but not a whole lot to do except gasp on the, you know, at what's going on the ground. It's obvious that he's kind of part of the Fly's group, but no one really acknowledges that. And yeah,
I only know his last name because of the text piece.
Yeah, exactly. And that text piece is actually very helpful for filling some of the gaps here. But, you know, again, that does get filled in on later issues. And I guess Matt Lowe decided to give us the backgrounds of the people who were kind of in the thick of the action at the time. And I suppose figures that Arnie will get his fair shake eventually. But yeah, poor Arnie. He gets very little to do and very little attention. And he doesn't even get a name until the very end.
I may be miscounting also. I mean, they pack a lot of story into this. And this was when I was going to say the leads at Marvel were 17 pages, but I just did a quick flip through and I only counted 15 story pages, which doesn't make sense. They ever went that low, at least on a regular basis.
Right. This feels like a big comic.
Yeah, it feels like a lot of stuff is happening, but it's economical in its storytelling and still finds time to have two separate ads for the very comic that you're reading.
Yes. In it.
There's a half page ad and there's a little blurb at the end of the bullpen bulletins.
Yeah, no, I mean, you cannot fault Marvel for that, because Marvel did push this comic. You know, it was not something that they were going, we'll try. And if it's going to burn out, that's fine. They pushed this comic. I mean, I think they really had faith in this.
Yeah.
And I could see it. I mean, I'm like you said, I'm not sure exactly why it got canceled. I don't know if it had low numbers or if it was just part of the whole industry implosion. or just a combination of factors. But, you know,
licensing fees can always be a thing. Although, right. You know, obviously, you know, Star Wars wasn't in trouble, but they wrapped up all of their Burroughs estate license stuff within that same window. Micronauts chugged right along for years. You know, ROM was still a couple of years out from happening. But and then this year, I think aside from Star Wars debuting, they did, I think their next movie adaptation was Jaws 2 as a magazine, and then Battlestar Galactica came out in 78, and that was about the extent of licensed books for them that in this kind of immediate window.
Yeah, and 78 is when the series ended. So it's, you know, and it could have been a whole lot of things. It could have been all of that. It could have been the fact that stuntmen were already kind of fading in the public consciousness. It could have had something to do with the licensing from Remenseri. Maybe he didn't want to renew the licensing for some reason. Or maybe it just had to do with the fact that the human fly disappeared and now they lost their hook. Yeah, it could have been any number of things. But I personally am sorry. Every time I reread this, and I do reread this, this title, I'm always sorry when I get to the last issue because I feel like I feel like Mantlow had a lot more story to tell.
I think he really does tend to think long-term with his work. I think most of what he's done, he's got a big picture and he does as much of it or would do as much of it as he could until either, you know, cancellation or some other factor would intrude. But in some cases, you know, Micronauts and ROM, he got to tell the whole story. Hulk, he basically did. I never read his Alpha Flight. Cloak and Dagger, I'm not sure if there was a proper end there. And same with Swords of the Swashbucklers. and I know he's done a lot of other stuff too, but those are the things that kind of spring to mind as being things he really followed through long enough that he either, you know, they were his characters essentially, or with Hulk, he put such a stamp on them that they may... that Hulk may as well have been his for the 5 years that he wrote it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's another thing, too. I personally love these, but maybe the fact that it is so limited is part of the reason. I don't know how far you could have gone with this character, honestly, just because it becomes kind of a situation of the weak comic, which were starting just on the verge of falling out of favor, I think. And I don't know what kind of legs the human fly was going to have after so many issues. I think maybe it could have gone to 25 issues, maybe a little more, before it started kind of getting too repetitive.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking also at the same time, I did forget about two other books that made it, I think, into 78, Shogun Warriors and Godzilla.
Right.
And again, licensing fees. And Shogun Warriors did get a proper, well, it kind of got an ending and then it sort of got a tie up loose ends without actually using the characters in a couple of issues of Avengers and Fantastic Four, which Marvel was always good at. If they could come back to something, even if it was sort of a sneaky thing like that, they would do it. But yeah, those two books also died out. So that may have been a licensing thing. Maybe Star Wars was doing so well that they didn't want to pay Ho or whoever. But
yeah, I think Marvel might have been spread too thin.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this, Patrick. Do you think? Well, let me ask you a two-part question here. what do you think was the human fly's standing, I guess, in the Marvel universe? And do you think there is a place for him now?
I think this is the kind of character that could be brought back in a way that would be effective and interesting. I haven't thought through what that would be, but I believe the idea of someone really grounded in reality, particularly if the living brand of Human Fly had continued to do things, then there would be more to work with. Mm-hmm. But somehow Marvel just owned the Human Fly concept outright or had some sort of ongoing licensing deal with it, I think with limited updates, you could really make it work.
Do you think he would fit in the current Marvel universe? Could he?
Yes. And I think that you could do it with some very minor tweaks. I think that there's the sense of teamwork and the diversity and adversity that each of those individuals face, because their diversity isn't just, say, you know, mentioning that Blaze is a Black woman. That's mm-hmm. not the extent of her diversity. Her diversity right. comes from her life experience. And one of those things, for example, is being a pioneer in a field that would have been closed off to her previously. And I think you could still do that now with some minor adjustments and have someone that is a success outside of the parameters of the expectation of the individual. And I don't know what form that would take, what that would look like.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could, because, you know, with the deep decompression of comics, the show business aspect could be interesting. I know that doesn't always work. I think, say, with like Dazzler, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. And I know, again, I'm going back to Disco with that.
Yeah.
I feel that you could do an entertainment-based character that's their shoot. You know, so many heroes are doctors or journalists of some sort or have no visible means of support, period, that having someone that's in the entertainment industry could actually be a refreshing and interesting take
mm-hmm.
on the lead character. And I know there's got to be somebody I'm not thinking of right now because I'm not very up to date with things that have been happening in the last decade. So I'm falling short on who that would. Okay, here we go. Not in this tone at all, but the Snagglepuss comic book.
Mm. Yeah, Mark Russell, yeah.
Yeah, the memoirs of somebody that was in the entertainment field and had some, you know, struggle and strife due to their identity, etc. That's proof that there is space for this and I realized the Hanna-Barbera characters aren't quite in the shared universe, but mm-hmm. it's adjacent enough. I think this character could make the leap into it and be part of Marvel.
I think so. I think so too. And that's it's one of those things where it in a weird way he is almost an innocent himself, and that's where I have trouble trying to fit him into modern comics. But I still do. I think it could work. I really do. And I think if nothing else, maybe put him in a Marvel adventure book. You know, bring him into the Marvel universe that way. But yeah, I
would
like
prefer that to like a mature Doom Patrol take. And I really right. hesitated.
Right.
For instance, I didn't want to make a comparison to the Tom King Mr. Miracle series.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the tone I think that would be appropriate for this character.
Yeah, I think that would actually take away from what works about the Human Fly. Mm-hmm. And I think it would add something to it that was never meant to be there. I think, yeah, and I think the tone just wouldn't work. And I really think you don't need to change his supporting cast much at all. I think they're pretty much perfect as they are.
Yeah, yeah, minor changes. So Ted Locke now, we know that he would have legitimate mm-hmm. control over his hands. That's possible technology now. He wouldn't have hooks, but he could sure. have been to mm-hmm. Afghanistan and suffered a massive trauma and mm-hmm. had prosthetics.
Yeah.
Blaze Kendall could still be a pilot and maybe her training, not to bring up Afghanistan twice in 20 seconds. you know, she could have a compelling story easily. And it doesn't have to be that she's a pioneer in her field, but she could be. She could still be a feminist icon
mm-hmm.
With very little reworking of her backstory. And, you know, Arnie Berman is the agent. I think we have enough good examples of interesting agent characters in mass culture mm-hmm. that's not a hard space to fill, whether it be, you know, Jeff Garland on Curb Your Enthusiasm
mm-hmm.
or, you know, the more bizarre version that was in Maria Bamford sitcom, or you know, there are a lot of examples of that, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, the Harmony White character I think is an easy
Oh, she's you know, totally character working to plug for in. She's working for a trash website that's barely journalism.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or, you know, some online, quote unquote, news, you know, magazine, something like that. Yeah, that's very easy to plug in. Yeah, I think
and the thought of doing stunts on social media, I'm like, why aren't people doing that? Do people do that? Is that what all those, you know, is that what Tosh 2.0's career was built on? Was people doing dumb crap that their smartphones captured?
right. You know, yeah, there's, and yeah, I think there's a lot of potential there. And you know, I personally would love to see the human fly come back in some sort of way. And I think there's room for him.
So your thought on the sort of pure motivations and almost not quite naive innocence, because I wouldn't want to play him as an airhead. Mm-hmm. But what are your thoughts on how he as the core character would work? You know, does he need more fleshing out as an individual? Do you maintain the mystery of who he is, or does that become tedious? Do you need more of an inner life with that kind of character?
I think he could definitely benefit from more of an inner life. I would prefer it not to be all spilled out in like one origin story and then that become his motivation. But I would, but I would like to like have hints dropped here and there. I would like to see him, if it's the same setup, I would like to see him mention his wife and children, to talk about how he misses them and how they inspire him in some way, you know, to express grief, I think, you know, and then not to make it, you know, this heavy comic or anything like that. But I think even lighter comics, you know, have a history of having a story here or there that dealt with heavier issues. And I think you could do that with the human fly and not bog it down.
Yeah. I mean, I think of the first thing I thought of when you said that was the short cartoon Snoopy Come Home.
Yeah.
It is.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Wrenching, but it's still peanuts.
Mm-hmm. Precisely.
And I realize that's not comics, but you get the point.
Yeah. That's comics adjacent. And
Schultz approved. It's continuity.
Yeah. You know, and my God, I mean, Snoopy Come Home just devastated me the first time I saw it. I was like, what did I just watch?
Devastated me when I was 30.
Yeah.
And 45.
Exactly. You know, and I think you can do that. I think you could do that with a character like the human fly and still, you know, because he's not naive and he's not even necessarily innocent, but I would say he's good hearted. And I'm going to make a big comparison here, but I would say he is good hearted in the same way Superman, when he's written at his best, is good hearted. Mm-hmm. He does things because it's the right thing to do. You know, no other reason for it than that.
He does. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people. Spider-Man is on the plane and he does the right thing.
Exactly. Exactly. He's
like, I'm the guy here. He has no idea who Peter Parker is. He just knows there's something going wrong and he's going to fix it.
Yeah. You know, and people can say that this is naive and this is, you know, soft-hearted liberal tears, whatever. But they can, but you know, it's, I like that in my heroes. I like heroes who do things because, heroes who are heroes not because of what they do, but in a sense, why they do it. And not because of angst and not because of tragedy and not because of guilt. But because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. And those characters, when written well, are absolutely some of my favorites. A well-written Captain America story or a well-written run of Captain America will instantly put him in my favorites category for that period. I feel the same way about The Flash. There are certain characters that when exactly the right note is hit with them and people understand that their motivation is not a tragic one, but an honorable one, and they do it correctly, it really lifts it up and prevents it from being corny or sappy or jingoistic or, you know, any of the traps you can fall into if you don't hit the right note.
So I have one last question for you, Patrick.
Yeah.
Would you recommend The Human Fly to people today?
I would I would recommend it to adventurous readers, people who perhaps prefer off the beaten path stuff. I like this sort of thing better than I like, in a lot of ways, better than I like Spider-Man or Superman. I enjoy them, those characters very much. But I really do like the oddball stuff. And this falls into oddball in a interesting way. And the thing with oddball things is it's tough to compare them to other books. So I can't say, well, if you loved Prez or Lee Elias's epic Ultra the Multi-Alien, which I want to mention for the second time in this.
This oh, yeah. No. Mention Ultra as many times as you can.
But if you like kind of pure expressions of unusual comics that are sort of... Comics like these are, even though they're licensed, are allowed to be personal in a way that something that is more of a flagship trademark title is not permitted to be. And that is in no way tearing down those things, but that's why I like these sort of short run series. I'm always drawn to those over something that's got a 50, 60, 70, 80 year history as far as collecting goes. First off, it's quick and easy and they're cheap. You know, I found my whole set at a used bookstore for $7, save one issue that cost me like $2 somewhere else. So yeah, I love it and would recommend it to anybody that likes something a little different, that wants to mix it up and is curious about 70s comics and 70s pop culture and mass media. There's one other element here too that is unique to this book because it came out when it did, and that's the hijacking.
Yeah.
Hijacking itself was almost an entertainment. It in itself was a stunt and a sport. Yes, in this book there were high stakes, but one last time with D.B. Cooper, the context in which that particular event happened, some of the people working on the plane at the time said, oh, well, we just thought this was going to be one of those hijack things where you fly someone to Cuba and you get off the plane and you get to party for a little bit and you get back on and you go home. Hijackings were generally harmless. They were either political in nature or they were literally, I need to get to from point A to point B and there's an embargo. So hijacking was very much a part of the 70s dialogue and 70s culture. Sometimes there were scary moments, but in general, it was something that people in the airline industry viewed as, well, that was another wacky day at work.
Yeah, and it was surprisingly common.
So that this story takes this and uses that as a launching point for the villains is another element that really does connect it to the pop culture of the time. So this is really infused in 70s culture in a very unique way.
It's also just a fun book, you know.
Oh, it's a good time, yeah.
It's edging right at the, well, I don't know, maybe it steps right across it, but it's right at that level of being almost, I don't want to say ridiculous, but almost too unbelievable, even for a comic. But it's fun. I like all the characters. I like the stories. The setups are usually pretty silly, you know. But this one, like you said, you know, it makes perfect sense. It's a time capsule of its time because all of those things were in the news in one way or another. It's a lot of that Matlow magic of just pure craziness wrapped up in extremely good storytelling with great art. It's a fun comic to look at. And as you're saying, to me, it is one of those comics that really just kind of epitomizes what a good 70s comic could be, even if it was something you had never heard of.
Absolutely. Yeah, the creative team is rock solid. Even though at the time Matlow hadn't been around that long, he had already sort of proven himself. He'd had a couple of years at Marvel at this point. Everybody else in that lineup is someone that either had done great work previously. I don't know how long Joe Rosen had been around as a letterer. I'm that's not my area of expertise, but he certainly dominated the late 70s and early to mid 80s just on his work with Frank Miller and Daredevil. So just some really fantastic people involved in this. And they didn't have to do that. That's the thing with these licensed books. They don't have to throw a superstar on it. And Lee Elias wasn't a superstar, but he was reliable. Mm-hmm. You knew he could tell a good story professionally. It would be clear storytelling, and it would be interesting and inventive where it needed to be.
I think you're absolutely right. It's just, it's better than it has any right to be. I guess is one way to put it.
If there were a Bill Mantlo biography, that might be it, because he did do so many licensed books, and they were all better than they had any right to be. And the longer he had to work at them, the better they were.
Yeah, and I think The Human Fly is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else to say about this issue?
That's it.
Thanks so much for being on this first episode of what's going to be like The Human Fly itself, a limited series here. I'm happy to say that you are going to be back with us for the last episode.
I can't wait.
Yeah, to talk about issue 19, and we'll wrap it up all then. And there's still a lot of comics in between to talk about. Well, you know, again, thanks so much, Patrick. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much, Max. And it's been a ton of fun. This is such a wonderful little known series, and I'm so glad that just a little over a decade after we first shared an interest in it with each other, that we're here talking about it.
Yeah, finally.
Yeah.
All right. Well, okay. You know, thanks again, Patrick.
Thank you. Bye.
And thank you to our listeners. The Death Defying Human Flycast is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. If you'd like to subscribe or leave a comment for the Human Flycast, you can do that on our website at fireandwaterpodcast.com or on Apple Podcasts. You can also find the Human Flycast on Twitter at Human Flycast, and be sure to follow and tag the network with hashtag FWPodcasts. You can also reach me at humanflycast@gmail.com. If you'd like to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, and why wouldn't you, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/FWPodcasts, where you can make a one-time or monthly contribution and unlock various rewards, including getting name-checked on this or any network show of your choice. Support the network and reap the rewards. And remember, the wildest superheroes are real.